Hi everybody. So I'm gonna try to be quick and painless since it's very late and it's late for me too. Well, I radically changed the topic of my talk today, which was supposed to be about hermeneutics, philosophical hermeneutics and new media. Well, for two reasons. First of all, because I'm sure that it would have been rather boring for you listening to me talk about the differences between ontological hermeneutics and information theory and critical hermeneutics and literary hermeneutics and so on. But I would anyway I would like to make some statements about what, according to me, digital hermeneutics is. So just three really short statements before starting. And what I'm going to offer today is a kind of practical example of what I call digital material hermeneutics. And it's the result of a paper I wrote with some colleagues, these colleagues of me are part of a research group called Collettivo La Boezie, who's working on the concept of voluntary servitude. So just three very short statements. The first one is that I believe that digital technologies are hermeneutic tools in the sense that American philosopher Don Eydig gave to this notion. He made this distinction between three kind of relations, embodied relations. When I, for example, I use my glasses, then I don't have any perception of my glasses, but I have a sort of direct access to the world, according to him. It's rather problematic. Then we have hermeneutic relations. So I don't access directly to the world, but access to something that is a representation of the world, and in this sense it needs a sort of interpretation, like a thermometer, for example. In the third case, we have what he calls alterity relations. For example, when I play with video games, where it's not the world is not emerging, but I play with the technology which has a sort of, it seems to be a human being because I interact with this kind of thing. So I think that digital technologies can be defined as hermeneutic relations, but they are also hermeneutic tools of a specific kind, since they tend to reduce the distance between the world and its representation, between the so-called territory and the chart. Or we can say, as it has been suggested this morning, the chart becomes and produces the territory. And I think that Hermeneutics can give a good interpretation of this kind of technologies, but I'm thinking about a specific kind of hermeneutics, which is material hermeneutics, which such a terms I'm thinking about two traditions. The so-called post-phenomenology, which is a tradition developed in the 80s by the American philosopher Don Eydig, and then that has been further developed, for example, by the Dutch philosopher Peter Paul Verbeek. But I'm also thinking about another kind of tradition, which is material hermeneutics developed by the German philologist Peter Zonde. So what is, according to me, interesting in this tradition, literary material hermeneutics, is that it's both object-oriented and context-interested. So what I'm proposing is that an hermeneutical approach to digital technology must be object-oriented, so it has to focus on a specific object, but at the same time, it has to articulate or to think about a critique, which is, in my opinion, must not be a sort of Marxist or neo-Marxist critique, as by contrast is the case of Peter Zondi, who was thinking about the first representative of the Frankfurt school, Adorno and Horkheimer. But okay, so my effort is to articulate an object-interested research, but with the effort to make a sort of critique of the context. This is precisely the case of this paper I'm going to present today. So the second reason I decided to change the topic of this research is because I was reading Maurizio Ferrari's last book about mobilitazione totale, and I noticed that you mentioned four times the concept of voluntary servitude. But according to you, in your book, you said, according to me, voluntary servitude is an interesting concept, but it's rather moral and it's not structural. And moreover, there is a difference between willing something and to understand something. So in this paper, I'm trying to suggest that the notion of voluntary servitude is a structural concept to understand the relations between individuals and what I call socio-technical system or technical systems in social media, but it is also a sort of tool for making people understand their own condition. So, let's start with the paper. Goal of this paper is to offer a sort of new theoretical framework, or at least to integrate the existing theoretical framework for thinking the relation between individuals and social technical systems in social media. And the paper will be divided in three sections. In the first section, I'm going to offer an oriented interpretation of the literature on the topic. In the second section, I'm going to introduce the political category of voluntary servitude. And in the third and last section, I'm going to make this notion operative in the context, specific context of social media. So, surveillance in social media. Probably most of you already know this famous cartoon capture that appeared on the New Yorker in 1993. Is wrote on the internet, nobody knows your dog. And this is a sort of reinterpretation of the same cartoon capture, I think 15 years later. Remember when on the internet nobody knew who you were? Well, this is, according to for me, somehow representative of a sort of evolution of the internet in the last 15 years. So, when I speak about surveillance and control in social media, of course, I'm not just referring about surveillance and control, because I think, as for example Foucault did, that surveillance is control is a matter of making individuality as such. Surveillance and panopticism are not just matters of power and control over the individuals, but they are rather means for constituting individuals as such. According to Funny George, we can distinguish between three aspects of digital identities. We have the declarative element, which is the moment where we make the inscription to the service, like in the case of Facebook, when we give our gender, our name, and so our religious beliefs, and so on. Then we have the active element of our digital identities, which is when we interact with other people, like I posted your picture, or now I'm friends with someone else, and so on. And then we have the third element. The third element, the calculated element, is represented by all the numbers resulting from the system calculation, which are generally visible on the user's profile, like you, me, and someone else, like this. You have 1,000 friends, 2,000 friends, and so on. Well, I would like to suggest that in these three elements, we have just like three kind of seasons of the evolution of virtual environments and social media in the last 15 years. As Danaboyd suggested, in the late 80s and early 90s, the declarative element was rather dominant, because many academics, she suggests in this article wrote in 2001, imagined that virtual environments would offer a sort of utopian world where sex, race, class, gender, age, and sexual orientation cease to be relevant. It's the famous real-virtual distinction, which was quite popular in the 80s. Then, with the birth of the social web at the beginning of 2000, something changed. We could say that we shift from a regime of anonymity to a regime of nonymity, which is the its contrary. So, for example, once again, Dana Boyd with Judith Donat said that in social networking sites, not social media, are usually identified by participants are usually identified by their real names, and they often include photographs, which are real photographs of real people. Their network of connection is displayed as an integral piece of their self-presentation. So, for this reason, interpreters or academics start to think about social media as sort of panopticon. I'm not going to explain what panopticon is. A lot of you is are philosophers, so I don't
you
think...
You were in panopticon. We all were in panopticon.
So everybody has a sort of notion of what panopticon is. Well, here's an explication. But a special kind of panopticon. Why? Because... we are as control at the center of the prison, while everybody else is around me. That's a sort of reverse panopticon. So here are some fancy definition or some fancy expression that have been used in the last years to define social media, like data surveillance, super panopticon, panoptic sort, electronic panopticon, until liquid surveillance suggested by Zygmunt Bauman and Lyon in 2013. Well, but this is not the end of our story, because in the last, let's say, 5-10 years, we assisted to a sort of two phenomena, at least. First of all, we have a sort of re-centralization of the web based on user data collection, analysis, and monetization. Here I refer to one book and an article, this book Les Fins d'Internet, published in 2014, and more famous article by Gerlis and Hellman about the like economy. And the second phenomenon is that in 2013, The Guardian revealed that the US National Security Agency obtained access to the system of Google, Facebook, Apple, and other US technology and internet companies. So, in this general atmosphere of re-centralization, surveillance, and control, academics start to think about social media as more classical form of panopticon, where there is one controller, which is the technical system, Facebook, Google, and so on, and all the control are and the controlled are all around it. So, for example, we have Christian Fuchs, who wrote that Web 2.0 platforms like Facebook are panoptic machine because they are based on identification, classification, and assessment of great amounts of data concerning the users. And last year, Andreevich and Gates introduced the term big data surveillance. Well, I think that all this literature is really interesting. And what is surprising for me and for us in our research is the fact that there are a lot of initiative, public and private, about making people more aware of this situation. For example, here I don't know. We can skip these images. Oh, okay. Maybe we have time. For example, this is a video that made by the European Commission in 2012 about entitled "Take Control on Your Personal Data." So it's just 1 minute long, so we can watch it if it works. No, it doesn't work.
That's why.
It's not working. Okay, I'm gonna skip it. And this is another example. This is the Do Not Track, which is a personalized documentary series about privacy and web economy. And this is an example. Is the every time that I watch news on the website of The Guardian, all the trackers, and all the trackers when I have fun on Facebook, which is Facebook because Facebook sell then all the data to other companies. So what I'm suggesting in this at the end of this first part, is that it is surprising that today, I believe, both the man on the street and the man in the laboratory are increasingly aware of the surveillance exercised by and through social media, but not much seems to be changing in their daily practices. So it's really amazing that not much is seems changing, despite all the awareness that we are developing about this. So in this of course, I believe that over the time, social media developed complex strategies in order to improve surveillance over individuals. And of course, individuals themselves are disoriented by several factors. But, and I will discuss about that. However, this might be just part of the truth. My hypothesis is that next to the fact that users are forced and cheated by the system and distracted by other factors, there is also an element of voluntary servitude. Put differently, panopticism does not go as far as breaking the direct relationship between awareness and emancipation, which is a relationship as old as Plato's allegory of the cave. So let's go to the second part, which is about the notion of voluntary servitude. I'm not an expert of this notion, and in this room there is the colleague of mine that wrote this part of the paper, so if you have questions about that, you can ask him. But just to take some points, the discourse of voluntary servitude was written by Étienne Laboétie when he was 18 years old. He became the best friend, Michel de Montaigne's best friends. The text was condemned and burned at stake in 1579. As a manuscript, it circulated underground and it influenced philosophers and thinkers like Richelieu, Hobbes, Rousseau, Marat, and then when it was published, Tolstoy, Gandhi, and so on. And then it was prohibited by Nazi during the occupation of Belgium, which is really interesting because it was the only book published before 1800 to be prohibited. So the question is, which is the unbearable concept content of this text? Well, the unbearable context is that Laboétie, looking at the French people, which was at the time oppressed by its tyrant, wonders how was it possible that one single man could succeed into subjugating millions of people. According to him, it was not certainly not by his own strength, as he was nothing more than a man, rather it was because the subjugated themselves provided him the support. And this is a quote by Étienne Laboétie. Where has he acquired enough eyes to spy upon you if you do not provide them yourselves? How can he have so many arms to beat you with if he does not borrow them from you? And so on. So, according to Laboétie, servitude is not a matter of coercion, but rather of voluntary submission. And the shocking evidence consisted precisely in the fact that although controlled, beaten, robbed, killed, and humiliated, subjects continued to grant their support to the tyrant. And in Laboétie's perspective, this was a paradoxical situation that could not be simply attributed to some degradation into individuals, soul, and mind, like cowardice. So this is an important aspect. Submission cannot be attributed to any internal, like cowardice, degradation, or external constriction, like cheating, like Panem and Kierkegaard's, bread and games. So the very important aspect of this notion is the fact that it represents the attempt of tying up two different facts. Human beings' will of freedom and their reiterated submission. Two different notions that goes at the same time. At the same time, similarly, the discourse itself is both a condemnation of any political domination and a sort of reproof of people's reiterated choice. So this is the idea at the heart of this notion. So I'm gonna skip this this aspect, the fact that the notion has been explicitly refused by philosophers like Hegel and Foucault, but has been defended by, in the system justification theory, by Cohen or Orwell with his notion of double thinking. And I'm gonna arrive to the end of the second part. In conclusion, we can highlight four elements of voluntary servitude. The first one is its disadvantageousness. It's really hard to say this term. Submission is a radical form of uncertainty because it always depends upon power arbitrariness. Second aspect, collective subalternity. Servitude presupposes a condition of submission to a form of power, a submission that singles out a collective dimension. Third aspect, potential awareness. Submission cannot be reduced to a form of constriction, deceit of power, of deceit of the power, or miscalculation of the subjugated. Servants are aware of their own condition, or at least they could easily get aware if they choose to. At the end, the most problematic aspect, which is the fact that we can abstain from this condition. If the serfs choose their submission, then freedom is just a matter of abstention. I will discuss this point in the conclusion. So, let's arrive to the last part of the paper. In this last part, I'm going to discuss the problem of privacy in social media. And I'm going to discuss about privacy as the counter discourse of surveillance. In fact, if surveillance is the capacity to exercise control over the individuals, then privacy is the ability that these individuals have to seclude themselves or information about themselves. Now, it's interesting that in the literature on the topic of privacy, almost everybody is agree with the fact that Facebook users became increasingly careful in this year in protecting their data from their peers, from the other people, but however, they ended up in increasing their personal disclosure to other entities on the networks as well, third-party apps, and directly advertisers, and Facebook itself. Everybody agree with this fact. But there are two tendencies. Some of the academics attribute this general loss of privacy in front of the socio-technical system to the fact that over the years, social media like Facebook developed complex strategies in order to exercise better surveillance over its users. So its users, it's the socio-technical system fault. The introduction of specific default settings. This is, for instance, an image of the changing of the default settings between 2005 and 2010. Or the continuous updating, the general complication of the privacy policies, and more recently, transparency. For example, in January 2014, Facebook introduced its privacy basics. Of course, privacy basics give the possibility to each one to better control our privacy in front of before our peers. But if one looks at the data policy, you discover that Facebook says, we store data for as long as if it necessary to provide products and services to you and others, including those described above. And this is the most interesting part because he says, information associated with your account will be kept until your account is deleted, unless we no longer need the data to provide products and services. So, I mean, you're not owner anymore of your data. So part of academics debates move in this direction. It's because the socio-technical system developed some strategies. The other half of the debate went in another direction, saying that the loss of privacy or the loss of control depends on a complex interaction between individuals' behaviors and the socio-technical system. This, for instance, the result of this article published on Science in 2015 by Acquisti, Brandimarte, and Lobenstein. I'm gonna skip this aspect, but these are the two main tendencies. Well, this is because of the socio-technical system or because the poor users were cheated and because there are external factors which are interiorized. Well, I believe that And we believe that these perspectives have the merit to show how social media works as apparatuses in the sense that Giorgio Agamben, critical thinker Giorgio Agamben, developed this term. According to him, an apparatus, dispositivo in Italian, is literally anything that has in some way the capacity to capture, orient, determine, intercept, mode, control, or secure the gesture, the behaviors, the opinions, or the discourse of living beings. So, in other terms, an apparatus is whatever is able to exercise power and control over individuals on one hand, and forge individuals' attitudes and expectations on the other hand. This is precisely the case of social media, insofar they create the condition of their own exercise of surveillance. Social media exploit individuals' digital identities and create at the same time the conditions that make digital identities exploitable. So, in this respect, these two positions are very interesting. However, we wonder if is there a sort of third element? Is there a third element in this process of submission and control which is not entirely ascribable to external reasons or to the internalization of these reasons? Put differently, my question is if there a voluntary and, so to say, positive way in which users adhere to surveillance exercised by and through social media. It is not my intention to give an answer to this question, and I'm not sure I have a complete answer to this question. I consider more important to pose the question, but I would like, nevertheless, try to suggest at least one avenue to explore. And this avenue has to do with the concept of zeal. What is zeal? Zeal is not simply when we follow the orders, but it's when we make a little bit more than following the orders. We are zealous. And I think there is a lot of zeal in social media like Facebook. Every time that we somehow contribute to improve some tools or some aspect of this social media. This is, for example, an example. When we contribute to improve the news feed on Facebook, Facebook give us the possibility to improve Facebook, they say, for your friends. We like to, as you can see on the right, we'd like to hear your feedback. Please answer a few questions about your news feed. But this is even most obvious and more clear, according to me, in the case of the Facebook ads. Facebook ads was introduced by Facebook in 2014. And ad preferences is a tool explaining to user why they see a specific ad. And the reason why I see a specific ad is that one of the reasons you are seeing this ad is because Timberland, in this case, wants to reach people interested in shopping and fashion. There may be other reasons you saw this ad. For example, Facebook is always able to use information about your age, gender, location, and devices you use to access Facebook when deciding which ads to show you. Well, of course, according to Facebook, ad preferences give users the possibility to manage their ad preferences, to have more control over the ads, I quote, to have ads that are more relevant and useful, and to see things you're interested in. However, Facebook makes clear that changing your ad preferences influences which ads you see, but it will not change the total number of ads you see. So, it's just to create more efficacious and effectiveness in their ads. According to Facebook, ad preferences represent a great opportunity for the user, but they like to say that it is also, of course, a good deal for advertisers and for Facebook itself. Now, I rather struggle thinking that people is not at least partially aware of this. In fact, it is rather common sense that advertising brings more advantages to the companies than to them than to their potential clients. For instance, if we take the Wikipedia definition of advertising, which is a rather common sense definition, it says that advertising is, I quote, a form of marketing, a marketing communication used to persuade an audience to take or continue some action, usually with respect to a commercial offering or political or ideological support. Hence, I would say that anytime that Facebook users manage their ad preferences, they are being somehow zealous toward the technical system, and they are assuming a sort of active role in their own submission. For this reason, I think we can agree with Zygmunt Bauman, who, explicitly referring to the concept of voluntary servitude, affirmed that, I quote, "we may be bound and caught, but we also jump in, plunge and live and dive in of our own will." So that's just a brief conclusion. I conclude with two questions, and then we can discuss about that. So the first question is that, is the notion of voluntary servitude just a description, sort of a tool for interpreting reality, or does the notion offers also a possibility of emancipation? Can we have a use of this notion? And the second question is maybe the notion of voluntary servitude suggesting another different idea of subjectivity, an idea which we might call postmodern? At least something like that has been just suggested once again by Giorgio Agamben in his really short essays called What is an Apparatus? He says, the more apparatuses pervade and disseminate their power in every field of life, the more government will find itself faced with a sort of elusive element which seems to escape its grasp the more it docilely submits to it. Thank you very much.
I would... Since you mentioned the reference due to this idea of a voluntary servitude, I have just an explanation to give. I mean, I believe that the frequency in which contemporary think refers to voluntary servitude is a transformation of the classical discourse of alienation. Because the classical discourse of alienation is we are free and we are intelligent, and the apparatuses transform us in a stupid and slave. The voluntary servitude says we are free, we are not free, and how so? The apparatuses transform ourselves. I believe, in a sense, that what is inadequate to this discourse of voluntary servitude is that still remains the idea that we are basically a rational agent, which is not the case. The problem I speak very roughly of collective stupidity is a real political issue, if we are not able to cope with, in a sense, we admit that humans are mortals, for instance, or influenced by interest. But in order to understand their behavior, we have also to start from the hypothesis that humans are basically stupid. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, we miss the point, and it was usually happen.
Okay, just three remarks. First of all, you're right about alienation, especially in your book when you're speaking about Agamben and alienation. You're perfectly right, and I was wrong into quoting Agamben, because Agamben has a sort of idea that apparatuses are rather...
At least itself.
Yeah, he suggests this idea. Well, and I think you might be right in the concept of voluntary servitude as being as the concept has been conceived by Etienne Laboetie himself, but there have been many reinterpretations of the concept. And for example, Claude Lefort's explication of the concept is that there is no an authentic being, and but he tried to give exactly a sort of constitutive interpretation of voluntary servitude. In your book, for example, you say, well, they speak about voluntary servitude, but it's a social condition. And it's precisely what Lefort tried to suggest. We speak about voluntary servitude, but in reality, it's our own condition. So, and that's the problem, because servitude and emancipation are really close to each other. We have emancipation, but emancipation risks to become servitude, and servitude is really close to emancipation. So, and the third element is that in this paper, I tried to put voluntary servitude in a precise framework, which is the panopticism. I'm not gonna, as I said at the beginning, it's not a new framework, but it's simply the need to integrate an existing framework. So I completely agree with the fact that there is a socio-technical system, and this system is rather constructive of our own subjectivity identity. I also agree that we are cheated and by this system, etc. But I just wonder if there is a small third element. At least I wonder if academics should ask themselves if is there a sort of, because in all the discussion that we had, for example, yesterday morning, like Antonio's discussion, etc. It's always the bad guy. The bad guy is always the system. Is always Facebook, Google is the bad guy. So just my question is, could we maybe think that we have our own responsibilities in all this? So that's the simple question.
Yes, and I agree. We are responsible. At least I am responsible.